Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Former UK Foreign Secretary David Miliband recently said after 9/11, Al-Qaeda was able to send the most powerful country in the world into convulsions. He argued the West has spent a decade focused on this threat instead of building an interdependent world. Joining me here in this studio to talk about global views of the United States 10 years after 9/11, Tom Jelton of NPR. He is the national security correspondent for NPR. Tom Jelton, I want to thank you for co-anchoring this program with me this morning.
It's my honor, Diane.
Well, you have traveled to and reported from so many countries in the world. I know you'll be able to both share and elicit wonderful comments from our other guests. We go to London to Lionel Barber of the Financial Times. Lionel, in fact, was one of my first members of the Friday News Roundup all those many years ago. Good morning to you, Lionel.
And really nice to hear your voice.
And it's good to have you with us. And also joining us from Claremont McKenna College in California is Min-Chin Pei, whom I see on Skype. Good morning to you, Min-Chin. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning.
And now let me also invite listeners to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Tom Jelton, let me start with you here. How does the world view the U.S. today, 10 years after 9/11?
You know, it's been an interesting trajectory of views, Diane, because, of course, recall that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was a huge international outpouring of sympathy for the United States, even from countries that were adversaries. You know, I have spent a lot of time in Cuba, and of all countries, even Cuba was expressing sympathy for the United States and sort of solidarity with the people of the United States. And Le Monde, the newspaper in Paris, famously put in a headline, "We are all Americans now." So in the immediate aftermath, the United States really enjoyed great solidarity and sympathy from around the world. But what's happened, I think, briefly in the last 10 years is that the United States has been humbled by its inability to achieve military dominance over its adversaries, and I think humbled by the decline of its economic power and its standing in the world, so that we now see in opinion polls around the world more people seeing China as the world's number one power than the United States. This is the change that has occurred over 10 years.
Tom Jelton, he's NPR national security correspondent. Turning to you, Lionel Barber, how would you say that the world sees us now, 10 years later?
Well, I would just like to go back to that initial period after 9/11, where, as Tom was saying, there was universal sympathy across the world. Cuba, Sudan, China, they all signed up into this kind of coalition against terrorism. But some, of course, were fair-weather friends. They were never going to stay the course, and some used the so-called war on terror declared after 9/11 by the Bush presidency as an excuse for cracking down on domestic dissent. And you can see that, for example, in China and other countries where there are ethnic tensions. What happened, of course, is that the decisive moment came not after the invasion of Afghanistan, but the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, where the U.S. In effect was cast itself as a rogue nation, not prepared to go through the United Nations Security Council, and essentially said, we'll go it alone. We don't even really need Britain as a military ally to do the necessary business in Iraq. And crucially, also served notice that it was willing to attack or tackle other countries deemed to be in this axis of evil, sponsoring terrorism or harboring terrorists. That was the moment that solidarity split. If you go back, forward to today, I would say that America's standing has recovered in large degree. Maybe everybody's not quite so enthusiastic and starry-eyed about the Obama presidency as it was in 2008-09. But still, people, and particularly people who know America, admire the spirit of self-renewal. And they would also give some credit, even perhaps to George W. Bush, who identified the aspirations of Arabs in the Middle East for democracy and for casting off the yoke of autocracy.
Lionel Barber, he's editor of the Financial Times. And now to you, Min-Chin Pei. Would you agree with Lionel that, in fact, empathy for Americans began to wane shortly after the attack?
Oh, absolutely. I think even in China, which viewed the U.S. much more skeptically than Western democracies, the 9/11 attacks did engender quite a great deal of empathy or sympathy among the people. But soon that changed. The feelings in China were more mixed. I think there was certainly resentment against American unilateralism on the one hand, but there was also a great deal of sense of relief, because prior to 9/11, the new conservatives in the Bush administration were obsessed with China's rise. They saw China would pose a long-term threat to American dominance. So policy toward China was hardening, but 9/11 happened, and then China thought, we're off the hook.
Min-Chin Pei, he's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. And now joining us on the line from Cairo is Ambassador Nabil Fahmy of the American University. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you for having me, Diane. It's good to be back on your show.
Are you there, Mr. Ambassador?
Yes, I am.
Good. Exactly. From your perspective, how did the U.S. decision to go to war in Iraq change perceptions of the United States after 9/11?
Well, I think perceptions changed four different ways. Started off with empathy because of the attack. It then shifted because of Iraq, and also because of the language used, to explain the war internationally, the loose language used rather than the objective, to animosity, particularly with the beginning of the Iraq War or the lead up into it. Then it went back into enthusiasm with the election of Obama because of the feeling that America can reinvent themselves. And presently, it's fallen back a warm sense of apathy. There still is a warm feeling towards America, but there's a frustration that America is not delivering, a disappointment. But the animosity is not there any longer.
Ambassador Nabil Fahmy of the American University in Cairo. Tom Jelton, we often hear that countries believe that America has somehow lost its moral authority. What is the meaning of that?
You know, the United States is famous around the world for its 200-year tradition of protecting and upholding individual rights and civil liberties as defined in the Bill of Rights, a document that is really without parallel anywhere in the world. And this is part of America's reputation. It's part of what has made America such a symbol to peoples around the world. And what's happened in the last 10 years, more than really at almost any other point in American history, although there certainly have been other wartime moments where our protection of civil liberties has been compromised. But what's happened in the last 10 years has been really a historic shift in the direction of security concerns overriding privacy and civil liberty concerns. And this is something that really inevitably, I think, has changed, has probably weakened America's reputation as a nation that really symbolizes and affirms civil liberties.
You know, in our last hour, focusing on the domestic changes, Laura Murphy of the ACLU talked about those changes that have gone on here in this country. But of course, that's affected everyone coming into this country as well.
Well, the United States, you know, again, has been for decades and decades has been seen as a safe haven for refugees fleeing persecution. And now people coming into the United States have to be fingerprinted and questioned. And it certainly has been an unsettling experience for them.
Tom Gelton, NPR National Security Correspondent. We'll take a short break. When we come back, your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. NPR's national security correspondent is here in the studio. Tom Gelton has certainly been a guest on this program many times. This morning, I asked him to co-anchor our program, which includes Lionel Barber of the Financial Times, from the BBC in Cairo, Egypt, Ambassador Nabil Fahmy. He's founding dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University in Cairo, and Min-Chin Pei. He joins us from Claremont McKenna College in Claremont, California. Tom Gelton, you've got a message there to read for us.
A couple of them, Diane. First, Wendell, who wrote on Facebook, just in view of what we were just talking about, the way that foreigners feel when they come to the United States now. He has traveled a lot in the Middle East, he says, and he quotes a Saudi friend telling him that in the past, when he landed at an American airport, he felt as if the roof had been lifted and that he was a free man under the open open sky. Now he fears for his safety and that of his family. This is the feeling he says his Saudi friend has when he arrives at an American airport nowadays. Shirley writes, also on Facebook, she thinks that the reception that President Obama continues to get when he travels means that our country and our president remain respected. And she says that taking out Osama bin Laden made us look impressive to a number of countries. She's concerned that about what she says is the growing number of Americans who don't care what other countries think of us and who don't understand that we are in this thing together. I'm curious whether either of our other guests, Lyon or Mingqing or Ambassador Fahmy, has this sense from abroad that Americans no longer care that much about what the rest of the world thinks of us.
Ambassador Fahmy.
Well, in fact, you've never actually cared that much. What I think you need to know, and when I say this, I mean, if you move away from the shoreline in America into mid-America, Americans, because it's a big continent, it's a rich country, and this prosperous country, are basically concerned with themselves. I don't think, however, you can afford to do that any longer. We live in a global society today. You have international interests, and there are also international threats, which if you don't deal with, will ultimately also affect your interests. So I share the concern, but this is not new. This has been there for a long, long time.
And Ambassador, you're saying this as a former Egyptian ambassador to the United States.
Yes. When I was traveling the United States, beyond the shoreline, beyond the waters, I would be received, frankly, as a novelty. As a curiosity. After 9/11, it was more difficult, of course, because people were concerned about our region. But just to sort of see somebody coming from Egypt was it's like a new film on the block.
Mingqing Pei?
Yes. I travel a lot. One of the ironies for travelers nowadays is that it takes more time to get through an American customs and immigration control process, which is supposed to be a free country, then going through China, which is supposed to be unfree. You whip in and out of China very quickly and takes longer. But I think in terms of how the Americans view the rest of the world, there is a very worrisome trend. When you look at the current presidential debates, you feel that, because it's all about the U.S. How the U.S. relates to the rest of the world does not come up. And some of the American policies that have huge impact on the rest of the world, such as its energy policy, is rarely mentioned. So this obsessive focus, inward-looking nature of the political dynamics in the U.S. today is deeply worrisome to the rest of the world. There's another trend which is parallel to this, that the rest of the world probably is now feeling that it can get away without American involvement. And if these two trends continue, we're going to have more trouble ahead, because the world today is so interconnected and we need global solutions to global problems. And America is not leading.
Lyon, one of the comments that Shirley made on Facebook was that our cooperation with NATO, and she didn't say it, but I bet she's referring to Libya here, makes us look like a team player. In view of what Mingqing just said, that the rest of the world may now be thinking it can get along without American involvement, is that really the view from Europe in the aftermath of this operation in Libya, when really the shortcomings of NATO and of the United States NATO allies have been underscored?
Well, I hope it's not the view, because as you say, Tom, Britain and France, who took the lead role, somewhat skeptical view in Washington, in saying that we needed to impose a no-fly zone and use military force against the Gaddafi regime and help the rebels topple Colonel Gaddafi, we ran out of munitions within a matter of weeks. And I would tend to side with former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who gave a blistering speech in Brussels just before he stepped down, saying essentially NATO is becoming irrelevant because countries are not stepping up. They either don't have the military capacity. Remember, we've got, if you include the United States, more than 2.5 million people in uniform, military uniform, in NATO, and yet we struggle within our own European limits to come up with anything, a fighting force of 30, 50,000 that we can deploy at any for any length of time. So the danger is this is a European problem. It's not an American problem. Mm. We need to be more relevant. And if you we've talked a lot about America being diminished over this decade. I can assure you, coming back from America in the middle part of this decade and living in Europe, Europe has become seriously diminished since 9/11.
Well, Lionel, that's what I want to ask you about. Why do you think Europe has, and especially Britain, have gone through this period of deep financial difficulty? Is it in any way connected to 9/11?
No, it's connected to the great financial crash, which happened in 2008, and to the structural, the fundamental flaws in the original design of the monetary union, which now encompasses 17 members, with sharp divergences between countries in the periphery, in the Mediterranean, Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, and the other outlier, Ireland, all of which were speculated wildly on real estate, had unsecure banking systems, were deeply uncompetitive vis-a-vis their stronger North European neighbours. And the fact is that the response has been poor, poorly designed, and there are questions now about whether this can survive. I would say on balance that I still think it will, but this is the real problem in Europe. Uh-huh. The second issue, which is related, is that we don't have a federal union in Europe. It's not like the United States. We don't have one system of government. We've got we have a horse called the European Union, and we've got 27 jockeys.
Uh-huh.
And you know, in a race, it's not good if you're riding one horse with 27 jockeys.
All right. And to you, Ambassador Fahmy, what about the killing of Osama bin Laden? To what extent do you believe that restored some prestige to the United States?
I actually believe that President Obama restored a tremendous amount of prestige to the United States when he was elected. In his inauguration speech, talked about that it was America's interest to be part of the world, and it was in the world's interest to engage America. And if I may, just to comment on what was just said.
Certainly.
My problem is, my perception at least, the problem is not that we have 21 or 25 or 190 at the UN jockeys and one horse. It's the problem is we don't understand it's a wagon rather than a horse. We have to work on this together. In terms of Bin Laden, Bin Laden's murder, his killing, his demise, whatever way you want to put it, frankly, was story for a day or two, 3 days, four. He, except for very few marginal trends, was not a hero in the Arab world. There were questions about how he was killed, but at the end of the day, that passed. We need to, whether it is in our part of the world or in America or in Europe, explain to our public foreign policy in a positive sense, not only in terms of threats out there. America's problem in foreign policy is it's always explained to the Americans the threats out there, and that's why they have to be there. There's the Soviet Union, China, NATO versus Warsaw, and so on. Europe is the same thing. There's no big threat out there that they can explain why they're out there. And we in the Middle East tend to explain foreign policy in terms of conspiracies against us all the time rather than trying to balance it out. These are the threats. These are the opportunities. That's why we make the investment.
Diane, can I just come in briefly and just say that there are threats out there? And if you happen to have been living in London, where we had suicide bombers on our underground, or you were living in Mumbai or Bali or Madrid in 2004, these were terrorist attacks which killed hundreds of people.
We were attacked by terrorists in the 80s before you were. I'm not saying that you weren't attacked. I'm just saying that there are negative and positive parts to foreign policy. We need to explain both of them.
Ambassador Fahmy, I'm curious, as you mentioned, after President Obama's election, there was a kind of a second bounce of appreciation or positive feelings toward the United States around the world. The Pew Research Center found, for example, 93% of Germans expressing confidence in Obama, 91% in France. And yet that bounce was far less pronounced in Muslim nations. In some Muslim nations, there is really no bounce at all. How do you explain that?
Well, at the very beginning, there was a tremendous bounce. I went to post-election parties to meet Egyptians and see what they were talking about. And I asked them, why are you so enthusiastic? And the answer was, Americans proved that they could be Americans again, that they could challenge themselves and elect somebody who was different, somebody who was engaging rather than wanting to do it alone. So there was this reaction to Obama, a positive one. With time, people started looking at, well, okay, has this enthusiastic result resulted in change in policy? Has it brought dividends to me? And frankly, one of the problems and the disappointments with the Obama administration has been the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, I'm not saying it's the beginning and the end of all the problems. I'm just saying that in the Middle East, this has been where the disappointment has been.
Mean Chin, how do you see it?
Oh, Obama's foreign policy? I think Obama's election was greeted in China as in elsewhere with a great deal of enthusiasm and expectations. And over time, this has cooled. That's because President Obama has encountered enormous difficulties at home, and that certainly limited his capacity to lead on the global stage. Regarding the killing of Osama bin Laden, I think it was rather anticlimactic in China, because by the time Osama bin Laden was killed, he was not exactly a central challenge to American foreign policy anymore. It was rather the global financial crisis and the war in Afghanistan.
Meet Gene Pei. He's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College in Claremont, California. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Fayette, Alabama. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Oh, and to the foreign correspondent for public radio, we really enjoy hearing your voice on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and I'm really honored to speak to the other two gentlemen as well. I love seeing more immigrants here in this country. My question is how foreigners see the average, ordinary American people, especially women, children, and the handicapped and other civilians who can't be military, and vis-a-vis the thing that angers the understandably angers most people in the third world, the USA's foreign policy. I'm thinking of the huge, especially the way the United States, ordinary Americans, extend their hands to people in other countries.
All right. Ambassador Fahmy.
Look, there are two ways to answer this. First of all, one has to admit that most of the world doesn't understand America. They understand, again, the shorelines and what they see on the movies. When I was traveling in America, I was always very well received. I was always received by very generous Americans and very warmly received. Presently, I'm at the American University in Cairo, and we have a lot of American students there, and they're treated very well. They're received with tremendous amount of warmth. Sure, occasionally there will be political debates about foreign policy, and they can go either way, and frankly, not all the Americans agree with the administration anyway, so it's not a negative point. I honestly believe that the anti-Americanism per se has decreased, but that the problem with the anger about foreign policy, or in this case now it's frustration rather than anger, remains. So the average American is still looked upon as something good, but not enough people know that because they don't travel inside America.
Mean Gene Pei.
Americans outside the U.S. are deeply, what should I say, loved by, admired by, as individuals, admired by other people. In my experience in China, when ordinary Americans travel in China, they are received very well. They're seen as friendly, as very approachable. very different from how the world sees American policy.
And Lionel, do you want to comment?
Well, I think those foreigners, people outside America who have a sense of history, would know that America has largely been on the right side of history, certainly in the 20th century. If you think of the fact that Franklin Roosevelt saved Europe from fascism, if you think of the way in which America constructed the NATO alliance, encouraged European integration after 1945, and provided the cornerstone to our security, all of this we should be very grateful for. And I think similarly in the States, I think there was a period between about 2003 to 2006, it had already changed by the beginning of the Bush administration, but that period where we talked about, or the talk was of, the axis of evil, and people had the impression that the United States military, the strongest in the world, could literally pick whatever target it wanted outside any rules of international law, and also was condoning torture. That did tremendous damage to America's standing.
All right, Lionel Barber of the Financial Times. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. From ESET, offering business network protection from viruses, hackers, spam, and cyber threats, eset.com. And from Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. This is NPR.
Journalist Alyssa J. Rubin spent most of the last 10 years reporting on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. She's now the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. On the next Fresh Air, she talks about disturbing trends in Afghanistan, the prospects for peace in Iraq, and how September 11th changed her life. Join us.
And welcome back, my co-anchor, Tom Jelton of NPR. You have a question for Minxin Pei.
Right, Diane. Well, Minxin, you said earlier in the program that before 9/11, the United States was, I think in your words, obsessed with China's rise. And you said it in order to, and your point was that we were at that point sort of favoring kind of hardline policies toward China. I think you could make the argument that in the last 10 years, we have been far less obsessed with China and far more obsessed with Islam as an adversary. And I'm wondering if that has been in some ways an unhealthy development. I mean, China and the United States are competitors. The United States does have to compete with China in fields of science, and business, research, technology. Perhaps we would have been better off if we remained a little bit more obsessed with China. What do you think?
Oh, I think for China, the last 10 years was obviously a golden decade because the U.S. was obsessed with Islam, with terrorism. Well, let me just give you some figures. They are astounding. On the eve of 9/11, the Chinese economy was 10% of the U.S. economy. Today, it is 45% of the U.S. economy. The eve of 9/11, China held $160 billion of U.S. debt. Today, it owns about $2 trillion of U.S. debt. And so I can give you all kinds of figures to show that if there was one country that seized the last 10 years to focus on its economic development, that is China. Whether a more competitive relationship between China and the U.S. will be good for two countries, it all depends on the nature of the competition. If it's military competition, then it will not be good for either country. If it's a much more friendly competition in science, economic growth, then it will be good for both countries.
Do you fear that there could be a military competition?
Oh, yes, I do fear that. I think it's in the long term because China is, after all, a one-party state, and the U.S. and China do not have fundamental strategic trust. And, as long as that distrust continues, there's going to be long-term competition, insecurity, and that worries me a great deal. But I want to say that the U.S. still remains in the scientific economic field a very dynamic, competitive player. The current difficulties may be short-term. When the Chinese sees the U.S. today, there are three different feelings. One is gloating on the part of some leaders who feel, the U.S. is now in decline. There's also puzzlement. A lot of people in China who say, how come the U.S. cannot get its act together at home? And then there's a third feeling that is worry, because there are people who in China who still believe that American leadership is necessary for this world.
Interesting, yeah. Tom.
You know, Lionel Barber, you mentioned the developments in the aftermath of Libya that sort of showed Europeans how much they still depend on the United States for protection, for security. And yet, on the other hand, there is this countervailing tendency where the U.S. Prestige, economic prestige and power has declined. We have a email here from John Kelly, who says that when I was in Western Europe this summer, I heard from many that U.S. responsibility for the financial collapse has diminished our standing in the world almost to the same degree as the invasion of Iraq. So from an economic point of view, listener is saying that the U.S. profile in Western Europe, for example, has really declined as a result of the financial crisis.
Well, I don't subscribe to the notion that the United States exported the subprime financial crisis to Europe and the rest of the world. It is true that the decision in Washington taken by Secretary Paulson to let Lehman Brothers go was one which was looked upon with some consternation by people such as the president of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet. We in Europe were a bit more aware, perhaps, of the risks of letting that go. But United States cannot be just merely blamed alone for the financial collapse. There are other reasons. For example, the global imbalances between U.S. and China, with China saving too much and America borrowing too much, which also contributed to the crisis. And those conditions are still apparent. I think the real issue is one which was touched upon earlier, which is if America really wants to regain its standing and prestige, it needs to tackle its own domestic problems in terms of entitlements and debt. And it can. It's striking that Admiral Mullen, the outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs, when he said he was asked, when he talked about the greatest national security threat to the United States, he did not say it was radical Islamic terror or Osama bin Laden. What he said was the indebtedness of the United States.
All right. We have an email from DeWitt in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who says, President Bush said we were attacked because of our, quote, freedoms. Why did al-Qaeda attack us? In all of the current 9/11 rhetoric, I've not heard this addressed. Ambassador Fahmy, do you have an answer?
I don't think it was because of your freedoms. I think that's a simplification of the issue and an attempt to sort of explain it to the American public, which is politically understandable, but I don't think it's precise. Bin Laden's original problem with America was his presence in Saudi Arabia. I would argue that the Bin Laden movement, the regime, Al-Qaeda, and all of that, built on that, but expanded it to be opposing America because of, it represented modernity, and they didn't want modernity in the Muslim Arab Middle East in particular. And then, frankly, and I don't want to appear to be cute by using this term, attacking America got you a much larger bang for your buck than attacking us in Egypt. And it did definitely gave a name to Al-Qaeda that people didn't know when they were attacking us in the past. So I think it was more about your presence in the Middle East, more about you representing modernity. Whatever the reasons, it is reprehensible and condemnable. But I don't think it was because of your values and your freedoms.
And do you believe that our invasion, our attack on Iraq and subsequently Afghanistan has helped to further the aims of Al-Qaeda?
Not directly, but it did in a sense that by raising the Iraq issue, you divided your supporters. I mean, before Iraq, people really felt empathy towards America. When you then raised the issue of Iraq and initially, or at least at one point, explained it as being also part of the war against terror, then you start dividing your own friends here because people will disagree with you politically on that act, but they don't disagree with you that terrorism is reprehensible anywhere in the world and against any target.
Tom.
Well, Diane, one of our listeners, Ryan, has written us this morning to say the United States is at war and has brought Al-Qaeda to its knees. So despite America's somewhat collective cultural insensitivities, I think it has done what no other country can do or is willing to do in the global war on terror. And in this regard, Diane, because this is the week before 9/11, we've had a lot of sort of presentations this week here in Washington about where things stand in the war against Al-Qaeda. Yesterday, John Brennan, the White House counterterrorism advisor, says that we are approaching, and this is his term, the strategic defeat of Al-Qaeda as a result of the death of Osama bin Laden, the raid on Osama bin Laden, and several other top Al-Qaeda leaders in the last few months. This morning, I was at a meeting at the Treasury Department where the evidence was laid out about the way that Al-Qaeda is really in a very precarious financial situation. So I think one thing to keep in mind, and I'm curious what, you know, our other panelists think about this as well, is that for all that these 10 years have cost us in terms of our values, in terms of our blood, in terms of our treasury, apparently we have, as a country, made progress in this battle against Al-Qaeda. That's something to keep in mind.
Minjin Pei, how do you respond?
Oh, absolutely. I think in a tactical sense, the U.S. has achieved enormous gains against weakening, if not ultimately eliminating Al-Qaeda as a terrorist network. But the change, the costs, as we all know, are huge. But the real challenge is long-term because we have to deal with the socio-economic and ideological context in which terrorist groups can continue to exist, if not thrive, in the future. And that's, of course, something that you cannot deal with at the moment. But in a, as I said, in terms of fighting the war on terror, the U.S. The U.S. success is enormous.
All right, let's go. Sorry, Lionel, you wanted to comment?
Just briefly, I was going to say, I think the Americans have done an extraordinary job in disrupting and destroying the Al-Qaeda network, decapitating it, if you like. But it's a mistake to talk in terms of victory. This isn't a conventional war. It's not where two large armies face off against one another, and at the end of a few weeks or a couple of years, there is a clear victor. This is a struggle, not just on the battlefield, but as we alluded to earlier, it's a struggle of ideas.
Tom Gelton, there are some people in our audience who believe that the media is making too much of the 10th anniversary of 9/11, that in fact it's the U.S. somehow extending its role as victim. And I wonder how you see that.
Well, I don't think there's any question, Diane, that we in the news media love anniversaries because it sort of gives us a ready-made excuse to do a whole bunch of stories that we might not otherwise find good angles to do. We have indeed at NPR and at virtually every other news organization seen just a tremendous amount of stories just in the last few days, in the last week around 9/11. But I think that the issues that we are looking at are important issues. And I think that this is an appropriate time to look. I mean, these 10 years have been so momentous in terms of the way that the United States has changed. We're talking here about the change in the U.S. role in the world, but also our domestic priorities. I think this is an appropriate time to reflect on all those changes.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Min Chin Pei, how do you see the U.S. role? Is this notion of its prolonging its victimhood something that you see?
Well, I hope the commemorations where the U.S. is holding today will dispel this sense of victimhood. I think the sense of victimhood was especially strong 10 years ago, and that led to a series of policy mistakes. But today, I think I'm glad that, in fact, the media and the rest of American society are spending so much time reflecting upon 9/11. And these reflections will give us a better understanding of why 9/11 happened and what occurred afterwards in response to 9/11. And as a result, the sense of victimhood will be weaker, not stronger.
Expand on your view of those policy mistakes.
Well, these policy mistakes, I think, twofold. Two dimensions. One is the foreign policy dimension. The U.S. became far less cautious in its use of force, and that led us into Iraq, which is a debacle for the Bush administration. And at home, I think the policy of cutting taxes, of loosening regulation, of encouraging asset bubble, this is to project this sense that we can fight a war, we don't have to pay for it, and that has created enormous long-term financial strains for the U.S. Economy. And, of course, now we're paying for the cost of these mistakes.
Tom.
Could I just interject here, Diane? I think the policy, some of the intellectual diagnosis was correct in terms of radical Islam being incubated in the autocratic regimes in the Middle East. But the execution was poor and flawed, particularly in Iraq. And just a couple of examples. Overestimating the efficacy and what you can achieve through military force, then saying that a conflict, for example, in Afghanistan is absolutely vital to national security, but then telling the military and letting everybody else know that there's going to be a deadline for withdrawal. All these inconsistencies, underestimating culture in the country. If you think that how we approached Iraq, it was a fundamental ignorance about how that country worked.
I have to point out that Lionel wrote a tremendous piece in last weekend's Financial Times about the very subject that we're discussing today. So, Lionel, I want to congratulate on that. You made a point there.
Earlier this week, actually, Tom, but that's sorry. Like a self-promotion.
Quoting World Bank President Robert Zoellick is saying that after World War II, the United States per capita GNP was only a quarter of what it is today, and yet U.S. voters supported billions of dollars in rebuilding efforts in Japan and Europe. What has happened that now, with our economy in comparison much stronger, the whole question of whether the United States should really help out has almost disappeared?
Well, I thought that Bob Zoellick's comment was fascinating because essentially he was saying America was a much poorer country back in those days, but it was still, to quote John F. Kennedy prepared to pay any, bear any burden, pay any price. And today, it's a lot more crab-like. But it was also an attack against, if you like, the bean counters' approach to foreign policy. I mean, if there really are matters of great security, then you have to be able, you have to pay that price. And if America is going to be a global power, then it needs to it needs to be able to pay for those policies. And the problem is that there is a whole generation in this in America that are not prepared to give up entitlements and not prepared to tackle this deficit and debt. And I could go on, but I'll sound like a congressman.
And at that point, we'll have to leave our discussion, as much as I am loath to do. Lionel Barber of the Financial Times, Ambassador Nabil Fahmy, former Egyptian ambassador to the U.S. He's now at the American University in Cairo, and Min-Chin Pei, professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, and to my co-anchor, Tom Gelton, NPR's national security correspondent. I thank you all.
What a treat it's been, Joe.
Thank you so much, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.